The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening, and welcome to another wonderful evening at the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name's Morris Williams, and it's my privilege to welcome you to, I think, one of the great treasures of Philadelphia is the author series. At year end, we're always thinking about charitable contributions and gifts for family and gifts for friends, but think about a gift for the Free Library, which is a wonderful treasure in terms of the branch system and the way it serves not just Center City, but all parts of the city of Philadelphia. So a gift to the Free Library will enable you to reach all parts of Philadelphia in making your gift. Tonight, we're going to hear Bill Cohen talk about his book, Four Friends, Promising Lives Cut Short. I know Bill from we both serve on a board together, and we both share as graduates of Duke University. But I think his range of writing is particularly outstanding in terms of his ability to focus on people that are living and their activities. He's written about Goldman Sachs. He's written about Lazard. He writes frequently about financial activity. He's written a book about Duke University and the lacrosse scandal of a few years ago. And he's currently researching a book about the rise and fall of General Electric. But in this book, he has tapped into his prep school days, his high school days going to Phillips Andover. And he writes about four of his friends who passed away in their 30s before they had a chance to fulfill their potential. One of the people he writes about is John F. Kennedy Jr. And one of the things that you might want to think about in terms of Q&A is that John F. Kennedy Jr. did have political ambitions. And in the book, you will learn that he agreed to step aside when Hillary Clinton said that she was going to come to New York and run for the senator. But the job he had his eye on was to be governor of New York. If he had been elected, and all odds suggested that he would be in 2002, that would have set him up for perfectly to run for president in 2016. So it might have been JFK Jr. versus Donald Trump. So we can simply imagine about that. But I want you to welcome to the stage Bill Cohen, who is going to tell us all about Four Friends.
Thank you, Morris, for that kind introduction. You know, I thought what I would do, since it's we're so intimate here, is sort of talk about why I did this book. You know, I'm not a particularly sentimental person. I also don't particularly like writing about myself. I was a hard-bitten investigative journalist in Raleigh, North Carolina for a few years, and then I went and got my MBA at Columbia and went to Wall Street, where I was sort of a hard-bitten M&A banker for close to 20 years. Then I left Wall Street and thought, you know, what can I do with my life? And I decided I wanted to write books. I don't know where I got that, because I hadn't written a book or anything in more than 20 years, and all I'd written before that was, you know, short newspaper articles. But I got this idea that I wanted to write a book about Lazard, where I had worked, which was a firm not for the faint of heart. And so I wrote that book that became a bestseller, was named the 2007, I can't believe it's been 12 years, the 2007 best business book in the world by Financial Times and Goldman Sachs. I then wrote a book about when I was here 10 years ago about the collapse of Bear Stearns called House of Cards, I then wrote a book about Goldman Sachs, wrote a book about the Duke lacrosse scandal, and then I wrote a book about why Wall Street matters, trying to what I thought would help people understand what Wall Street does and why. And so what I'm trying to tell you is that the idea of sort of writing a book about four of my friends and what happened to them was almost serendipitous. It wasn't something, and now it's more said I'm writing a book about GE. So it's anomalous. It's not sort of in my repertoire, other than I tend to write books about what I know, and I've realized this now. This is heading into my seventh book. Each book that I've written, I had some sort of nexus with. I had worked at Lazard for 6 years. I had competed against both Bear Stearns and Goldman Sachs. I went to Duke. I went to Andover. I worked at GE Capital, my first job at a business school. And the guy who was my office mate at GE Capital succeeded Jeff Immelt as CEO for 15 months before they unfortunately, unceremoniously fired him, which got me to want to write the book. So I like, apparently, it's on some subconscious level, to write about what I know. And that's why I decided to write this book about my friends from Andover. As Morris may have alluded to, all four of them died young and tragically. But I'm not in any way sort of preoccupied with death. I'm very much focused on living and enjoying and living my life. I have a wonderful wife and two wonderful kids, and I've had, I've been luckier in my life than most people have any right to be. But so I sort of approached it journalistically. As you get older, you notice that, I think we all can all relate to this, we start noticing that people we grew up with, suddenly pass away, and I was sort of in my mind, as I was writing these other books and writing my Vanity Fair articles and writing my New York Times articles, I was sort of collecting these facts that a couple of my good friends from Andover had died young and tragically, and we got sort of to a critical mass of these people who had died this way, and I thought, I need to, A, figure out what happened to them in their lives, because, we were together a very short time, 3 or 4 years, at a time in the mid-70s when, there were no iPhones, there was no social media, there was no way to be in touch. Essentially, guys don't write guys letters, except very rarely. If you didn't have somebody's payphone number at their college dorm, which is, of course, ridiculous, because who has that, you lose touch with people. And so we were all together for this very intense experience for, 3 to 4 years. I was there for 4 years. And then we go on about our lives, and the next thing you know, I'm hearing, 25, 30 years later, that they've died suddenly. And so I was immensely curious about how they had lived, how they got to Andover, what their families were like, how they lived before and after Andover, and what they did in their lives, and what led to these tragic events. And I thought I would try to figure that out, which is, it sounds easy to do, but it was actually incredibly difficult to do. With John Kennedy Jr., we knew him. I mean, he's the only child born to a president-elect in this country. He was born 3 weeks after his father was elected. He grew up literally living in the White House. And then he, of course, had to leave tragically when he was about three. So he, of course, has been famous his whole life. So there was lots about John. But so I didn't want to just regurgitate everything about John that had already been written. I was very focused on writing John's story through the eyes of the people who I knew, who were friends all together at Andover and beyond, and capture his story through his friends. But I think that what sort of came over me, and again, I'm not at all morbid. I guess I was more journalistic in the way I approached this. But even from an early age in my life, I've sort of was reminded that there's death too in life. I had a first cousin who we lived next door to in central Massachusetts, who had a brain tumor, and he died very young. I had another first cousin who lived around the corner. She had cancer and died when she was about 8. My uncle remarried my father's brother to a woman whose husband had jumped off the roof of an apartment building in Massachusetts. Again, I don't think about this in any way, any morbid or dreading way. Just reportorially, factually, these things happened. I went to a little school in central Massachusetts that used to be a farm. There were literally 10 students in each grade. So my whole time going there, until I went to Andover, I had 10 fellow classmates. And there was an award given out at graduation for this guy named Bruce Armstrong. It was called the Bruce Armstrong Award. And he happened to be a Christian Scientist, which, of course, I had no idea what that even meant. But I guess what it means is that if something happens to you, you don't believe in medicine, and so you don't get medical treatment. So he got hit in the head with a baseball bat, and his parents didn't treat him, so he died, and then there was the Bruce Armstrong Award. There was another kid, again, we're talking about 10 kids in my class. There was a kid who, I mean, incredibly, it's almost absurd to think about it. A kid named Brad Morrison, who for some reason liked to collect glass insulators. Now, nobody knows what a glass insulator is anymore, but once upon a time, on top of telephone poles, they had glass insulators that they would screw onto the little screw that stuck out of the top of the telephone pole. You know, the wire came across, and then you'd screw it down using this glass insulator, and it had ridges inside of it. And, you know, if you were a telephone man, you would climb up the telephone pole and replace the glass insulators. Now, by the way, they're ceramic, and they're brown, and they're ugly, but back in the day, they were actually beautiful, and they were glass, and they were green, and they were all these different colors, and people collected these things. Now, this is absurd, beyond absurd, but so then you had these like 12 and 10-year-old kids climbing up telephone poles to collect these things. So Brad Morrison was doing that one day, and of course he fell and got electrocuted. And that was a big deal, naturally, and I don't mean to make light of it, but I mean at the school I went to. And then there was another kid whose mother was driving him to school one day, and for some reason the car got stopped on the train tracks, and they got into a terrible accident. He died too. And so these events were like really big news at my school, because again, 10 kids in a grade. If you lose one kid, that's like 10%. I mean, I think it was sort of the, not the moral equivalent, but the numerical equivalent it must be like to, experience some sort of a gun event at school, horrific event. And so, I don't know, it had impact on me, but I wasn't like, again, I wasn't dwelling on it or thinking about it, but I think it just sort of collected. And then when I got to Andover, we spent a lot of time, again, I have no idea why, talking about the French existential philosophers, people with highfalutin names like Jean-Paul Sartre and Simone de Beauvoir and Albert Camus. And I was taking a class where you actually had to read these incredibly difficult philosophical texts in French, okay? And I was, 15 doing that, which, of course, means that my comprehension of it was pretty close to zero, and I didn't do particularly well, but I did get the basic gist, which was, you know, sort of the French existentialists had this idea that, you know, I think I'm probably getting it wrong. Again, I'm not a philosopher. I'm merely a journalist slash former banker, so that doesn't really qualify me for much. But, you know, that you should try to live life to your fullest every day because you don't know, you know, what day could be your last, and, you know, you want to sort of give it your all. I think that's sort of part of their philosophy. And I, of course, I would think about that, and I would say, well, if I knew I was going to die tonight or tomorrow, I wouldn't be sitting around trying to give it my all. You know, I would be eating macaroni and cheese or something. I mean, you know, being with my loved ones. So the idea that, you know, I never quite understood the philosophy or how you're supposed to put it into practical terms, but sort of this idea of living your life to its fullest because you never know what's going to happen one day to the next sort of stuck with me. And so that was, I think, the origin of this curiosity I had to try to figure out what happened to my four friends. And you know, there was Jack Berman, who was the son of Holocaust survivors, who's grew up on an egg farm in rural Connecticut, whose older brother literally raised him because his parents spoke only Yiddish at home, and his older brother, you know, his parents wanted him to be a rabbi, but his older brother didn't want him to be a rabbi, and so thought before he sort of got too far down the road of being a rabbi, he'd better get him out of rural Connecticut, and somehow stumbled upon Andover, read about it in a book, brought him up to Andover to apply, but of course the application process had closed. Got him into Andover, got him a half scholarship, and, you know, they had no money, of course, and sort of the rest was history, you know, ended up being in the wrong place at the wrong time in an office building in San Francisco. I then was curious about my friend Will Daniel, who's came from the exact opposite background. His grandfather was Harry Truman. His mother was Margaret Truman Daniel, the so-called mystery writer, although it turns out that she had a ghost writer who wrote all of her books for her, or most of them. His father was the managing editor of the New York Times, Clifton Daniel. They lived in a triplex on Park Avenue. And so that's about as far from rural Connecticut as you could get. Will was very smart, went to Andover, Yale, but also suffered from wanderlust and couldn't get far enough away from his family and his background. Fortunately, his name was Daniel and not Truman, unlike John Kennedy Jr., who could never get away from his name, his background, his pedigree, his looks. I mean, Will Daniel had the same kind of pedigree, but nobody knew it. So he was able to hide and live his life sort of as a bit of a recluse until he met his end. Harry Bull was from a fairly well-to-do family outside of Chicago that had an old a paper manufacturing company, one of the biggest businesses in Chicago for a long time. He was the first person that I ever met in my life who was a sort of a conservative political viewpoint. That was sort of interesting. At Andover in the mid-1970s, everybody was, you know, about as liberal lefty as it gets. You know, being in Massachusetts, what would you expect? But Harry was brilliant misguided for a lot of times, got his life together, was a big-time lawyer before his father asked him to come back and run the paper company. And then he had a horrible tragic ending with his two two daughters, and then, of course, John, who we all feel like we know, and I hope I provided a different perspective on him and his life. And so I wrote this book. If you can imagine what it would be like to go and talk to Jack Berman's widow or Harry Bull's widow, women I did not know, who I told I was doing this, and I can't even imagine what they thought, but they welcomed me into their homes and told me their stories of living with their husbands and the tragic days surrounding their death. If you can imagine asking somebody to relive that story for me, for my benefit, for a journalist's benefit, that was incredibly emotional for them, incredibly emotionally draining for me. Obviously, Carolyn Kennedy did not participate in this book, no surprise. Have not heard from her, but again, so many of my friends who knew John, and friends of friends who knew John, again from a totally different perspective, not a political perspective, but a real world perspective of what it was like for him to be John F. Kennedy Jr. And to be the focus of so much attention. I mean, literally, he would go to a movie opening where there was a red carpet, and John Travolta would literally be on the red carpet, and John would arrive, and all of the attention, all of the cameras would go and turn to him, and then John Travolta is just standing there thinking, what am I, chopped liver here? I mean, that's what his life was sort of like on a daily basis, and I literally would watch people, and I'm not the only one who noticed this, others who I talked to noticed this, literally changed their behavior when they got around him to try to make sure that the little bit of light that, I mean, could some, this powerful light that he possessed would somehow reflect onto them if they could only stay in his orbit a little longer. And so, people would warp and change their behavior just to be around him a little longer. It was remarkable, and as Morris was saying, there's no doubt in my mind as I talk in the book, because I talked and interviewed people who were closest to him at the end of his life. He was going to run for Senate from New York in 2000, but decided to stand down and let Hillary run, and she of course won. And then he was going to run against, in 2002, he was going to run against George Pataki for governor. Assuming he would have won that and did that for two or three terms, as Morris was saying, I think it's not hard to imagine we would have seen, two New Yorkers, different two New Yorkers, running against each other in 2016. And I, cannot imagine that John would not have, we all thought what was going to happen last time, but I would have assumed John would have won that race. So we'd be talking about President John Kennedy Jr. now, potentially. So it was quite an amazing journey. It was published into a time when, we were totally preoccupied with, books about Donald Trump. So this is obviously this couldn't be further away from a book about Donald Trump, thank goodness. And so it didn't make as much noise as some of my other books, but it was intensely personal, intensely rewarding, and I'm very proud of it. I'm very glad it's out there, and now I can sort of get back in my lane and do what I think a lot of readers expect me to do. So I'm happy to take questions from anybody.
Bill, I think the range of the four individuals about whom you write, I mean, we obviously focus on Kennedy, but I'm
curious. That's why I put him last, because I wanted people to,
But I'm particularly curious, one of your classmates was a victim of, I think was the worst mass shooting at the time that it took place.
Absolutely, yes.
And I'm curious how that might have impacted you in terms of your coverage of gun violence and the desire or not to write about gun violence. And then I'm also curious as to how your other friend's relationship with his grandfather, Harry Truman, shaped your perception of Harry Truman.
Very, very, very good questions. So Jack Berman was a lawyer in San Francisco, and he had, in about a year or two before he died, he had gotten into employment law. So he was representing people who had gotten fired from their jobs, who decided they needed to sue their employer because they were wrongfully terminated, which was a niche that he carved out of his law firm because his law firm was a more of a corporate law firm, of course, and so he convinced them to do this and that it was a good thing to do, and he was really getting it up and running, and this is the kind of guy he was, and he was he was present for this lady's deposition at the, she worked for EDS, and so they were at EDS's law firm's offices at 101 California Street, which is downtown San Francisco. Ironically, Merrill Lynch, where I worked, used to be in that building, may still even be in that building, and I used to go to 101 California when I would go to the West Coast when I was at Merrill. And so this was 1993, and Jack was in there in a conference room, a bunch of lawyers, deposition being taken, and this former client of the firm who was truly obviously deranged and very upset at the law firm to a fault. Again, there was, this is 93, no security anywhere. He came into the building with a bag full of semi-automatic weapons and just sort of gunned down 10 or so people. It was the worst mass shooting in American history at that point. But it led to the 1994 assault weapons ban, directly a result of that. Dianne Feinstein helped make it happen. And if you remember the assault weapons ban, because of political wrangling, it had a 10-year sunset. So it ended in 2004, which is why there's no assault weapons ban today, which is why there's all these mass killings with assault weapons. It's unbelievable. So, and then I don't write about mass killings. I don't think I could bring myself to do that, but it infuriates me, Morris, that we had a law that prevented these weapons, and because of political infighting in our dysfunctional national government, it had a sunset clause, and it sunsetted, and we can't seem to get it back. It's been 15 years, and how many people have died senselessly as a result? As far as Harry Truman, through the eyes of Will Daniel, my mother's family is from St. Louis, and I used to go to St. Louis. So I grew up in central Massachusetts, and my mother's family was St. Louis. So between the Kennedys and the Trumans, I mean, these were like, the ideal, political ideal in our family. And my mother found out that I was friends with John Kennedy Jr. and she couldn't control herself. I mean, and one weekend he invited me down to 1040 Fifth Avenue to stay. I mean, she was beside herself. So the Trumans were, of course, revered in my family. And what I will say is that at my Andover graduation, my grandmother was sitting next to Margaret Truman, Daniel. And my grandmother, was literally the salt of the earth, just the most wonderful woman. She died returning a pair of shoes to Saks. So she was at the graduation, and she turned to Margaret Truman Daniel and said, you know, isn't this a lovely day? You know, it's so nice to meet you. And Margaret Truman Daniel just sort of sniffed and turned her head and didn't even respond. So that colored how we thought about the Trumans. Will Daniel, he could not, I mean, I think he, you know, appreciated his grandfather. I don't think he got along particularly well with his parents. One of his brothers suffered from mental illness, and they sort of literally kept him away and put him in homes and didn't talk about him, and this infuriated Will, and he would have big fights with his father about this. You know, and his grandfather criticized Will for having long hair, for smoking cigarettes, for being a renegade in the 70s. You know, when Will, they, I guess the USS Harry Truman, the big, you know, battleship or whatever, was redesigned and rechristened, they put nuclear weapons on board. And the Daniels family was invited to the rechristening of the ship out in California. And of course, Will was very much opposed to nuclear weapons and the idea that this boat named after his grandfather would have nuclear weapons just like appalled him. But you know, everybody was saying, okay, now Will, try to hold it together. We're all gonna go out there as a family, try to behave. And so they go out on this government jet, they fly out to California, and he's with this woman who was his friend from Yale, and she's like saying, now Will, just try to behave, try to keep it together. Yes, the ship has nuclear weapons on it, but you know, this is a family event. Anyway, long story short, of course, in the middle of the ceremony, Will blew up, stormed away, and couldn't deal with it, and then sort of left the family, you know, just made his way back to New York, totally away from his family, and so he was a rebel. He was a rebel at Andover. He was a rebel throughout his life. He never married. He would have a, you know, I talked to his various girlfriends that he'd had, and he used to write his friends saying, I just started dating this new woman. I'm now going to break up with her tomorrow to get the breakup out of the way, because I know it's inevitable and I know it's coming. He couldn't commit to anybody really or anything. I came away with a more negative feeling about Will's parents than necessarily about, you know, Harry Truman.
How would Jacqueline Kennedy have felt, or did she know? I mean, when was JFK Jr.'s thoughts of going into politics, when did that become part of his certainty? And was it when she was still alive? And I would think she would have had deep conflicts had she known. And I don't remember precisely from all the things that one used to read about them, but it seemed like she was very protective of him. And I had this kind of recollection that in my head that the kids were also protective of her, that there was basically a good, loving, caring relationship there. And her experience of trauma with the assassination, I should think, would have really freaked her out to think that he'd go for that, because, you know, he would have been quite a target.
Yeah, all of that is true. Your recollection is spot on. They were a very close-knit family by definition. You know, you'll remember famously, or when she said after Robert Kennedy was killed, she said, you know, if they're killing Kennedys, I've got to get my kids out of here. And then, you know, she decamped to Greece, you know, for a while. You know, at the time of her death, John was just starting up George Magazine. So, which was, of course, a magazine about politics, you know, that tried to glitz up politics, you know, sort of a combination between, you know, Vanity Fair and, you know, The Nation or something, to try to, you know, make politics a little more interesting and glamorous. So, that's what he was focused on at the time of her death. And then he, you know, literally days later, he went right back to work. It hadn't come to fruition yet. But so, you know, again, I don't know whether this is true or not, but supposedly, and I reported this in the book, that there was a letter that she had given him on her deathbed that basically said, you know, fulfill your destiny, which I think to him meant go into the family business, which of course meant, you know, go for it. And that's basically, you know, at the time of his death, George was not doing well. It started with great fanfare. You know, the first two issues had more ad pages than any other magazine launch in history. But by the third year or so, it was really kind of, you know, he and his partner, Michael Berman, had gone their separate ways. It wasn't doing as well. Hachette Filippacci was thinking of pulling the plug. He was, in the days before his death, he was actually trying to get new equity into the company to replace or to get more capital to, because Hachette wasn't putting any more money in, and he hadn't put any money in. But it was clear to the people who knew him best that he was definitely getting ready to think about politics.
Good evening. Do you have any regrets in your reporting tenure? Do you have any regrets?
Well, I don't. That's an interesting question. Look, nobody likes investment bankers. You know, people did like, once upon a time, people liked journalists. So I sort of went from being liked professionally to being disliked professionally, even though I was the same person. I went into journalism to try to change the world. That's why to make the world a better place. So I left out a little bit of the story. I was a history major at Duke, and I was in the history honors seminar, and I wrote my history honors thesis about the French existentialists again. You have to have your head examined. And this time I was able, fortunately, to read most of it in English, because I'd realized by then that it had actually been translated into English and I didn't have to read it in French. But one thing that happened during World War II, like Jean-Paul Sartre was captured and put in a prisoner of war camp in Germany. And incredibly, and at that point he was a philosopher, and he wrote these big, thick books that nobody understood, Being in Nothingness. Maybe to a philosopher they made sense, but to normal people they were gobbledygook. But he got to this prisoner of war camp because the Germans, you know, were wary of having people like that walking around. And he convinced everybody in the prisoner of war camp to escape. He convinced them that it was their duty, that they had to take the risk to escape. And they did that. They all escaped, and this is what my thesis is about. They all escaped, and they, you know, he came back to Paris, and instead of, to answer to your question, instead of being a philosopher, he decided to become a journalist. He started a publication called Les Temps Modernes, Modern Times, And he became advocating for change, an advocate for change. And that had a big impact on me. So I wanted to, I thought erroneously, in retrospect, that a journalist could have real impact through his or her writings, just reporting. You know, for a while that kind of worked. When I was a reporter in Raleigh, I wrote a bunch of stories that got the school superintendent in Raleigh fired. You know, so that was, you know, action. But, you know, nowadays, you know, I just don't see that happening as much. There's too many inputs. There's too, you know, people are just drinking from the fire hose of media, and it's too overwhelming. I mean, yeah, stuff happens, but obviously the Me Too movement was journalists having a big impact. That's kind of exciting. But I don't know, I got it in my head that I could do something that would change the world. And, you know, then reality kicked in, and so I began to think other things.
What will the world think of Jack Welch in 20 years?
Well, I mean, they might think about him the way I write about him in my book. And so he's been doing everything in his power to make sure that I write about him in a, you know, favorable way, because he's very charming and very open. He's spent a lot of time with me, which I appreciate. I mean, of course, I'm a journalist writing a book, and so, of course, I appreciate having the chance to spend a lot of time with the quote-unquote world's greatest CEO. But I think that the truth is that, you know, Jack was a great leader and created, you know, the world's most valuable company. I mean, so if you're, the leader, the head of Apple, the CEO of Apple, the CEO of Microsoft, the world's most valuable companies now, I mean, are you considered a great CEO? I mean, he basically took a bunch of slow growth industrial assets and a low multiple financial services business and created, you know, this alchemy and got people to think it was the world's greatest thing. And so that's his special gift, to make people think that. But I think that, you know, already in doing that, the seeds of the company's destruction were sown. Now, he didn't think that or realize that, or he still doesn't think that, of course. But I think, you know, if one's objective about it, one would have to say that by doing the things that made it the most valuable company in the world, that made it a slow growth industrial company and a financial services company have like a 60 PE multiple, then you've set yourself or your successor up for failure, especially when, you know, the company was the world's most admired company year after year. Jack was the world's most admired CEO. Jack was the CEO of the century. I mean, who can follow that? Who can follow that? And so, you know, Jeff Immelt took over as CEO 4 days before 9/11. So that's what he had to deal with right off the bat. Now, he made plenty of mistakes, but, you know, following Jack was not easy. Following any legendary figure is not easy. Thank you all. Thank you all.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.